Blog Talk Radio.
Man, I got a great show today. For those of you who don't know, which is actually maybe even most of you, even though I know how much all you guys are political junkies, there's a Republican debate tonight. I say that most of you probably don't know because I didn't fucking know until yesterday. They just keep throwing them at us now. I mean, I'm such a loser, though, that when I see that, I get excited. Like, oh, yeah, we got debates. Ooh, isn't this awesome? So the Trump and Stein will steamroll everybody in sight yet again. It should be fun. Will I live tweet it? Fuck yeah, I'm going to live tweet it. But I have, you know, it is a nice little break every once in a while. Like, we've been, okay, debate breakdown this day, debate breakdown that day. It's nice to just give, you know, more regular news in a day every once in a while. But tomorrow's show, are we going to have some of the debate for tomorrow's show? Maybe, but I'm not sure. Because, you know, I won't have enough time to clip out all the different things I want to talk about. So we'll have some on the debate tomorrow. But then on Monday, I'll probably have some more specific clips that I want to discuss. Because with the Republicans, there's always something. There's always something that I listen to and I'm like, oh, my God, I have to rant about this for roughly 20 minutes. But today, we got Marco Rubio is going to try to explain away the fact that he sucks and he can't win a primary or a caucus, and he's going to go on Fox News to do that, and he just continues to embarrass himself. Literally every argument he uses, I'm sitting there, and it gets one is more pathetic than the other, and I'm like, all right, dude, you got to stop. He's the closest one to overcoming Trump, but I don't think it's possible for him to overcome Trump because he's just like – everything he does, it's like a fucking manual on how not to beat somebody like Trump. Then also we got a new survey out that explains over for conservatives in the future. I mean, young people are just overwhelmingly progressive and liberal. And I have to say, the numbers in the new survey are surprising even to me, to the point where there are some things that people under the age of 26 that they believe, a majority of them believe, that I don't even agree with it. That I'm like, okay, no, that's too liberal. Like, I'm more, way more moderate than you are. So we'll get to that. And, Jesus, what else I got for you? Obama, yet again, with the crumbling, utter weakness. Wait until I tell you what he's doing now to try to suck up to his Republican buddies slash not buddies who want to spit in his face. And I don't know, man. Stick around and you'll see what else we got. We got Ben Carson, who's questioning Obama's blackness. Ben Carson, of all people! We got a growing backlash against the BDS movement in the West. Of course, that's the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement to try to stop Israel occupying the Palestinians. So we'll talk about all that and much more. Let's get it started here, and we'll do that with pathetic Marco Bot. Marco Rubio went on Fox News to try and explain away Donald Trump's dominance in the election so far, and he's going to make the most pathetic arguments imaginable.
Then what's your take on these numbers? In seconds, got to feel good, but a distance from first, it's got to make you scratch your head.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the Nevada results are always a little different from what you see in other parts of the country. Their caucus system is different even from Iowa's. Last time, Mitt Romney got over 50%, so Donald Trump actually underperformed, but Mitt Romney did not once but twice in the state. Look, I've been saying this for a long time now. This is an unusual election. Throw out everything you know about presidential politics because this year is very different. It's been proven week after week.
No kidding.
And right now what you have is a situation where Donald, the majority of the Republican electorate, the majority of Republican voters in this country do not want Donald Trump to be the nominee. I think that's been pretty clear now. The problem is that they're divided up among four people. At some point in South Carolina, it was five people. Before that, it was seven people. So until there's some consolidation here, you're not going to have a clear alternative to Donald Trump. And the argument we've made is, I'm as conservative as anyone in this race, but I'm the conservative that can unify the Republican Party. You've seen it in the last 72 hours with a number of people that weren't with me initially. You know, a lot of the establishment people didn't even want me to run. A lot of them went with Jeb or whoever. Mm-hmm. But they're now all starting to consolidate across the spectrum in this party with the understanding that if we don't come together, we're never going to be able to provide a clear alternative to the direction that Donald Trump wants to take the Republican Party and the country. And I think voters are going to have to start making a choice here about not just what kind of Republican Party, but what kind of country we're going to have in the 21st century. Because I'm as angry and as frustrated as anyone. I've been angry and frustrated since 2010 when I ran for the Senate and had to take on the entire establishment in the U.S. Senate of Republicans. But I also understand that while anger and frustration can motivate you to do something, you got to know what you're going to do. And voters deserve to know how you're going to do it. And right now, all Donald says is, you know, he tells you what the result is going to be, but he refuses to outline how we're going to achieve these things. And voters deserve to know that because this is the most important political job on the planet.
Right, and you're going through the interview process, all of you are right now. Well, Senator Rubio, the argument that Senator Cruz is making, he says, look, I won Iowa. At least I have that under my belt. We need to congratulate you on your last two performances, getting second place, but at some point, do you need to start winning, and where can you do that? And we know you've picked up some high-profile endorsements since Monday. We can show you a graphic of that. Senator Orrin Hatch, Bob Dole, Tom Tillis, and the list goes on. Where do you see that you can win?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that you don't win the nomination by how many states you win.
You don't win the nomination by how many states you win. You know, some people say that the person who finishes first is the winner. I'm of a different belief. I kind of think that if you come in second and you keep doing that, then somehow you win. Is anybody buying this? You guys like this? Is this making sense? Oh my goodness, what a weak little bitch. Every time I hear this guy talk, I think, oh my God, Trump might actually be right about all of these guys. I mean, weak over here, low energy over there. What are these guys doing? They can't argue their way out of a paper bag. I know what I'm doing. We're going to win. Make America number one. Or what is it again? Make America great again, whatever the fuck he says. All right, so let me break down specifically some of the stuff he says here. This is incredible. First, he says, Okay. Donald Trump is dominating the race. You got me. He doubled the votes of the person who came in second. That was me. Absolutely curb-stomped my ass. But Mitt Romney in Nevada the last time around, he dominated by even more. And www.sothefuckwhat.com still got destroyed, bitch! I don't, like, what's so sad about this is you know that his staffers were trying to come up with cutesy little arguments like this to use, and then he uses them, and in their mind, in their dumbass little bubble, they're like, this is going to convince people to vote for me instead of him. Sure, he's dominant, but Romney was more dominant in Nevada, so you got to go with the guy who came in second but still got crushed. Yeah. You and your staff are helplessly stupid, Marco. Nobody's going to hear that and go, that's a winner. I'm with that guy. All right, then he says, Marco Rubio, of all people, said, you know, the establishment has been against me. Dude, you are the establishment. We've covered endless stories. There are specific stories about how Marco Rubio took money from certain donors, then lo and behold, he was on the side of a certain policy position, or he pushed legislation. Now, this race, Sheldon Adelson has been more sitting on the sidelines, waiting to jump in because he doesn't want to back the wrong people. Last time he wasted a lot of money on the wrong people. But in previous elections, Sheldon Adelson has backed him, and then Marco Rubio all of a sudden was like, I think gambling online is immoral. Let's fight against this. Meanwhile, Sheldon Adelson made all his money from casinos, from gambling. But he wanted to crush online gambling because he viewed it as direct competition to him and his business. So Marco Rubio was out there leading the fight. Like, oh, yes, this is so immoral. Let's fight back against this. Does this have something to do with the money I took from Sheldon Adelson? No, no, no. I'm anti-establishment. So he goes from saying the establishment is against me. By the way, he raised $77 million between him, his campaign, and his super PAC. running for president. 77 million! You're going to tell me you're anti-establishment? He goes from that argument to he calls for a consolidation of the establishment. Marco, which is it? You can't say, oh, I'm anti-establishment, too. All right, seriously, guys in the establishment, everybody else needs to drop out who's part of the establishment and then consolidate around me. It's one or the other. You can't be anti-establishment and then say, all right, let's all rally together, establishment, and pick me. And that part's actually honest, too, where he's saying, okay, seriously, everybody else who's anti-establishment, John Kasich, you have to go. Ted Cruz, who's more anti-establishment than Rubio, but still to a certain extent establishment, yeah, you need to drop out, too. Everybody needs to drop out. It's got to be me versus Trump in order for me to have a shot. That's actually true. But even with that, it ain't looking good for Marco Rubio. And then listen to this argument he uses against Trump. He says, Trump gives policy stuff, sure, but he doesn't give specifics. So, like, he's mad. Yeah, I'm mad, too. But he says what he wants to do, but he never says how he's going to do it. So vote for me. Wait, no, but you never say how you're going to do it either. All your stump speeches are Jesus, 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 God, 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 and fuck liberals. So you go out there and you do a shittier version of that than Donald Trump can do, and you're like, yeah, he gives policy stuff, but not details. So, you know, vote for me. No Republican voter is going to buy that argument across the board. What Republican voter has ever said, you know, that he's angry, and he's given some policy stuff, but I just want more details. That ain't the Republican voters who give a shit about details. So he doesn't have a core argument that really can try to defeat Trump. So what he does is he's just flailing. He's flailing like the glitchy Marco bot that he is. And the stuff that him and his staff come up with, they're just wholly unconvincing, which leads to the final point, which is, did you see towards the end there what they're trying to do? This is Fox News trying to help him out, too, and give him a little bit of rehabilitation or make it so he has a shot against Trump. On the screen, they put, you know, you have picked up some high-profile endorsements recently. Orrin Hatch, who negative 14 people care about. Bob Dole, who wasn't even relevant enough in 1996 because he lost. So who's, oh, I wasn't for him, but now I hear Bob Dole is for him, yeah. And one of the people who endorsed him, Tim Pawlenty. Tim Pawlenty is notorious for nobody giving a shit about him. Tim Pawlenty is the epitome of the establishment. He's quintessential establishment. And he ran for president recently. And what happened? I don't even think his family voted for him. The people in the media were like, oh, Tim Pawlenty, he's gonna make a run at this thing, boom, dropped out. If I'm not mistaken, it was like before Iowa. His poll numbers, I think his poll numbers were negative 32%. And they're like, all right, so he's struggling against Trump. How can we revive him? Tim Pawlenty. Bring out T-Pauls, y'all. T-Pauls, where you at, dog? Help out Marco here. Nobody gives a shit about Tim Pawlenty, but they don't have anything else to run to try to overcome Trump. So they use arguments like this. Tim Pawlenty's for him. He's cool. He's hip. He's with it. Tuck, 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 tuck. Hey, kids. He can do the Macarena for you. Will you vote for him? Please vote for him over Trump. Please vote for him. He can't help himself. He really went as far as to say, you know, the person who comes in first doesn't end up winning. Go ahead, Marco. Keep making an ass of yourself. You're going to face plant if you keep going in this direction with your campaign, and it's almost inevitable. Yes, for those of you listening on the live show, I was doing the Macarena as I was going, tuk, 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 tuk. It's copying the Austin Powers thing. All right. Now let's talk a little bit about them youngins. I mean, I say that, but I'm only 2 years outside of this age bracket, so I'm kind of still part of the group here, I hope. But I'll tell you what their opinions are. This is really something special here. Republican pollster Frank Luntz did a new survey that shows young people are done with conservatism. They have no interest in it whatsoever. So The Intercept reports here. They say 18 to 26-year-olds' biggest concerns in order are corruption, greed, and inequality. Now, let me pause here real fast. okay, that's correct. Not just, it's not just, hey, this is their opinion, which it is, and hey, this is number one, is corruption. They're just right. They apparently know more about the political system in the U.S. They do their research. They read articles online. They have an idea as to what the fuck is going on. They've immersed themselves in it. They're not just listening to the babbling heads on TV, the idiots who do mainstream talking points. They're like, okay, let's try to figure out what's going on here. They do some research, and they go, oh, easy. Corruption is the number one problem, followed by greed and then inequality. So I'm with them on the corruption thing. Greed, I don't know if I'd say that's the number two biggest problem, because greed is only a problem if the rules in the system allow the greedy to rig the rules in their favor. So it just greed in general, it's not all bad. Like, you want – I'm not anti-corporation, for example. I'm against the bad ones, and I'm against the ones who donate to politicians and rig the rules in their favor. But, you know, are there plenty of good corporations that don't do fucked up shit? Sure. And we should probably acknowledge that. So I wouldn't say greed is the number two problem, because there's all types of greed, too. I'm sure you could say Kobe Bryant or Tiger Woods, they were greedy in their lifestyle choice and their career. And, in fact, Kobe has said that. Yeah, it was just all about basketball. Super greedy of me, and I kind of neglected people around me. But it ended up blossoming into something beautiful and into an all-time career. So greed in and of itself is not the worst thing. There are examples of it being horrible. I wouldn't say it's number two, but I still get where they're coming from. So we got corruption number one, greed number two, and then inequality number three. They continue here. President Obama is not their favorite political figure. Bernie Sanders is. Indeed, 31% said Bernie Sanders is the major political figure they like and respect the most. Obama gets 18%, and Hillary Clinton gets 11%. So you ask 18 to 26-year-olds, who are like, Obama. Obama? No. Bernie Sanders. They have a sense of, you know, who's genuine and who sticks to their principles more and who's really a fighter on the substantive issues. It's just something that 18 to 26-year-olds have. Again, I think they're just more informed than other generations. Now, they say, in response to this, to the question, which type of political system do you think is the most compassionate? 58% said socialism, and 9% said communism. Just 33% chose capitalism. 66% of the polls responded said corporate America embodies everything that is wrong about America. Goddamn, son. Okay, so again, this is an example of them being more liberal than I am. So I just told you guys, I'm not against all corporations. I'm against the bad corporations who rig the rules in their favor and make it so that the system subsidizes them and screws over the other corporations. So I'm not against all corporations. I'm against the bad corporations, and I'm against the rigging of the rules. 18 to 26-year-olds are like, no, corporate America is everything that's wrong about America. Damn! Now, don't get me wrong. I've actually said before on air, in the U.S., I would vote for somebody who's to the left of me, because they're not going to get everything they want to get. So if you vote for somebody who's to the left of you, they'll fight really hard, and perhaps the compromise would be right where my political beliefs are. So, you know, I do have minor disagreements with them here, but I think the younger generation is on the right track. Now, when 58%, number one, said socialism is the most compassionate system, again, that's a little to the left of me. Now, I get it, the way they framed it, that's actually a fair response, because they just gave you socialism, communism, and capitalism. But I believe in social democracy, which is like what they have in Scandinavia. It's a mix of, it's the right amount of capitalism and the right amount of socialism. It's a hybrid system, like every modern nation already is, but perhaps it's a little further to the left on the spectrum, certainly to the left on the spectrum compared to the U.S. But the younger generation is like socialism number one, then capitalism, then communism at the very bottom. I have to say, I'm actually very happy that, you know, young people aren't going all the way to communism, because most versions of communism, at least how it ends up effectively being implemented, it's like authoritarian leftism, whereas different versions of socialism, like social democracy, that's basically libertarian leftism. So no control of your private life and stuff like that. You do whatever the fuck you want, but you have an economy that makes sense and kind of works for everybody. They say, in addition, more 18 to 21-year-olds chose Sanders as the person they'd most like to have dinner with than anyone else. ahead of Obama, Jennifer Lawrence, Ellen DeGeneres, Bill Gates, Taylor Swift, and Beyonce. Whoa, 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 whoa. See, here's where I go, that's it. That's it. The older generation, they're done with their archaic, draconian ways. More 18 to 21-year-olds said, I'd rather have Bernie with dinner Sanders. I'd rather have dinner with Bernie Sanders than dinner with Beyonce. Queen Bey, son? I go on Twitter quite a bit, as you guys know if you listen to the show and you follow me on Twitter. There's one person who I don't think I've ever seen a bad word spoken of in my feed. And I don't even follow, you know, entertainment accounts, pop accounts or whatever. But every time there's anything, whether it's from like BuzzFeed or something like that, about Beyonce, it's always a fawning love affair. Like, oh my God, Beyonce, we should make her queen of the universe and give her Neptune or something, bro. Oh, Beyonce. 18 to 21-year-olds are like, yeah, step aside. Bernie Sanders, I'd rather have dinner with you. Dude, the people running the system right now are dinosaurs. Obama is a dinosaur. Obama is a pro-establishment, pro-corporatist, centrist politician, or center-right politician. He's the same kind of Democrat as Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, the new Democrat, who they do triangulation. I sometimes agree with the Republicans, I sometimes agree with the Democrats. 18 to 26-year-olds are like, fuck off. The Republicans are crazy. And I said this on Twitter the other day. If you're a Democrat and you agree the Republicans are crazy, then when you say let's compromise and negotiate, aren't you saying, nah, let's be half crazy? We'll meet halfway between crazy and not crazy. Well, the younger generation gets that logic, and they say, yeah, no, I'm not interested in them. I think they're all corrupt. I think they're stupid with their fundamentalist religious beliefs and trying to push it on everybody. Here's what we believe in. We believe in actually trying to create a better society on this planet and, you know, doing a socialist system or a social democratic system and, you know, having it make sense. That's what we want. These numbers were so overwhelming that Frank Luntz, who's the Republican pollster who did this, he said when discussing it that the younger generation is, quote, terrifyingly liberal. TikTok to the older generation, because we're much better informed, policy stances are much more clear, and I think make much more sense, and once we get control, is it possible the system stays corrupt and then it waters down all the politicians and makes them corrupt to fit within the system? Yes, if we don't get money out of politics, that will happen. But is this generation much more likely to fight to actually get money out of politics and to push the country in the right direction? Yes. Yes times a trillion. Okay. Fucking A, man. I always take way too long in the first few segments. I got to take a break here. And then when we come back, I got the White House in their unbelievable, absurd top weakness and what Obama is trying to do next, which in his mind is a gotcha Republicans, but in the mind of any rational person is a dude, why did you just do that? So we'll talk about that. And then also the person who co-wrote the hilarious movie Idiocracy, he's coming out and saying, I did not expect this to be a documentary, but it has become a documentary. The U.S. political system is kind of looking like Idiocracy right now. We'll discuss that, whether or not we agree, disagree, why not. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back with all that stuff and much more. Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. Wait until you see what I got planned for you here. All right. The White House, in their utter weakness and desperation, are floating the idea of nominating a Republican. To me, this is Obama 101 at this point. So the person they have in mind is the Republican governor of Nevada, Brian Sandoval. So what's this guy's record like? Well, we know. We can take a look here. He's against gay marriage. I'll repeat that. He's against gay marriage. Now, to be fair to him, he actually was for civil unions, but he's against gay marriage. And he says, hey, it's a settled issue, but personally, I'm against it. So this is what qualifies now as a moderate. Can you imagine somebody being nominated who's like, you know, I'm personally against interracial marriage, but it's a settled issue, so we'll move along. Is that somebody who a so-called liberal should be nominating to the Supreme Court? I don't think so. He's for the death penalty. He's a giant question mark on the drug war. He's for Keystone XL. He's against tenure, and he's for public pay cuts, which he did as governor of Nevada. He's against gun reform, He's against immigration, and he's for lowering taxes. So this is a Democratic president who says, yeah, I'll show these obstructionist Republicans who don't even want to consider any nominee that I'm putting forward. What if I nominate a Republican? Aha! I got you, bitch! You got them what? You nominated somebody who is on their team. That ain't a you got them. They got you. You buckled. You cowered. You did exactly what they want you to do. Look, this is, you have to understand something, guys. This is part and parcel of what's wrong with the Democratic establishment. Now, some people say, hey, they do it on purpose, and this is the whole idea, they're supposed to lose. And other people say, no, they're just fundamentally weak and pathetic. But what happens is the Republicans run further and further and further right, and the Democrats always have to be the above-the-fray party and the centrist party, so they go, oh, well, you know, since we're the adults in the room, we're going to reach out to them and meet in the middle. But wait, the middle is no longer the middle because these jackasses just ran super far right. So when you meet them, now you're just right-wing. You're just on the right wing of the spectrum and pushing right-wing policies. So this isn't a compromise. It's a faux compromise. It's one group of obstructionist pricks who say no to everything and who run further and further right, and then there's you who buckle to their demands and oftentimes even go further than just meeting them halfway. You nominated a Republican. This isn't a win for you. This is a win for them. And you ready for this? Because this is, again, the new Republican Party 101. What was their response to this? Nope, we're not even going to consider him. Isn't that incredible? How incredible is that? They go, okay, we're not going to even entertain. We're going to do historic obstruction on this. The longest time of vacancy, you know, it was like 160 days or something like that, the longest time that there was blocking of nominating somebody to the Supreme Court and approving somebody for the Supreme Court. They say we're going to wait over 300 days. We're going to block it for over 300 days. And then Obama's like, no, I will show them. I'll nominate a Republican who they would agree with on stuff. And then they're still like, no. Don't care. Fuck off. Not going to do it. And if I know anything about Obama, what he'll do is he'll pick somebody who's even a little further to the right than this Republican. This is unbelievable. In Obama's mind, he truly believes, aha, I got him. You don't got him. They got you. This reminds me of Obamacare. We've spoken about Obamacare before, how the real Democratic Party position, the true liberal position, is Medicare for all, single payer. This is what Bernie pushes for. This is what the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for. Now, in the debate, they didn't really push for that back when we ended up getting Obamacare. They kind of were like, yeah, okay, single payer, push that the fuck aside, who gives a shit? Anyway, their starting position was the compromise, public option. We'll do a public option. not single payer everywhere, but just a public option to compete with the private market, and that's that. Now, when the Republicans heard that, well, they say, no, fuck off. Fuck you. No, I'm not doing that, not even considering it. So then the Democrats again caved. They caved at the beginning when they didn't take their original position. Then they caved again and they said, okay, let's do the individual mandate system. Where did that system come from? Well, we've spoken about it. Richard Nixon was the first to propose a version of it. Richard Nixon, Republican president. Heritage Foundation wrote policy papers on it. That's a right-wing think tank. Newt Gingrich, Chuck Grassley. Republicans supported it in the 90s, all throughout the 90s. Fucking Mitt Romney implemented that plan in Massachusetts. It's a right-wing plan, through and through. Even when he gave them the right-wing plan, what'd they say? Fuck off. I'm not voting for it. How many Republicans ended up voting for Obamacare? It was passed with all Democratic votes. So let me get this straight. All Democratic votes ended up passing Obamacare. Then why the fuck couldn't you get single payer? Well, you know, it's hard, the blue dog Democrats, this and that. Okay, no, but you didn't try. You didn't try. You didn't even try for the public option, really. You caved on that immediately. You're telling me you got all Democratic votes. You couldn't get at least the public option, but you couldn't get single payer? No, because they don't know how to play politics. They're not strong, and they want to give in. They want to compromise. They want to run to the right. Does Obama really have a problem nominating a Republican? No. Because they even slap him down, and he's like, well, please, you're begging them now to nominate a fucking Republican. And this is, by the way, the effects of strength in any political debate. Now, let's flip the script. Imagine the Democrats acted like this. The country would be so much further ahead now. If the Democrats were this aggressive and this strong in their positions, if Obama was this strong back during the health care debate, we would have single payer. Now you say, come on, Kyle, you know the blue dogs were against it, so how the fuck were you going to get it? Guys, it's actually very simple. It's not like no president has ever done it before. Look at FDR and what he was able to get accomplished. Look at LBJ and what he was able to get accomplished. What you do is you call the obstructionist blue dog Democrats, who, by the way, for those of you who don't know, are Democrats from a Republican-leaning district. You call them into your office and you tell them very simply, hey, look, here's the deal. If you do not vote in favor of this, you're done. Your political career is over. You know, pack it up, go home. Because at the time, you have to remember, Obama was very popular. His approval numbers were through the roof. So you have a very popular president telling you, if you don't vote for this, you're done. Now, how do we make it so that they're done? I will primary you. We will primary you. The Democratic Party will primary you in your next race, and we will dump all the money into your opponent, and I will go and campaign for your opponent in your state. How you like me now? So either, but hey, you can avoid all this, and we'll support you if you vote for single-payer health care. You don't think the Blue Dog Democrats would have crumbled there and said, okay, you got it. Let me explain something to you guys. Here's what the D.C. politicians care more about than anything else. Their ass. Their career. So you tell them that, and then, okay, I guess I'll have to do it, and that's it. And then we would have ended up getting a Medicare for All system. And then, by the way, would people have gone, oh, I hate this system? Fuck no. People would love this system. So, you know, it would have been a win across the board. But this pro-corporatist, center-right Democratic Party, they do stuff like this, and they think they got the Republicans. Yeah, I nominated a Republican, but I showed them Republicans. No, you didn't, you weak, pathetic punk. Unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. All right, now, let's go to this hilarious story about Idiocracy. The guy who created the movie Idiocracy and what he's saying now about American politics. Perhaps it's unsurprising. Ethan Coen, who co-wrote the hilarious movie Idiocracy, which I really love. If you haven't seen it, go see it immediately. He has a disastrous message for everybody about the current state of politics in the U.S. He says, people will email and post stuff on my Twitter that's like, hey, you predicted it right. So that's always nice. But it's not always nice because you want the world to become a better place. I never expected Idiocracy to become a documentary. Good googly moogly. This guy's like, yeah, no, it became real life. Now, I mean, obviously there's a little bit of hyperbole there. If you've seen Idiocracy, you know we're not that bad. But are we approaching it? Now, I assume he's talking about the rise of Donald Trump, though I don't really know. I mean, it's inconceivable that he's not talking about the rise of Trump. But yeah, what we have is like a buffoon narcissist with a meerkat on his head who's absolutely dominating the Republican race. And it's, I mean, there's a decent chance that Donald Trump is the next president of the United States. And if that's the case, we almost will have gone full Idiocracy. But I actually, you know, I want to slightly disagree with him here. I think he's half right and half wrong. Because there's this common belief, you know, and it, some people on the right believe this, some people on the left believe this. I've heard people like Bill Maher mention it, where they think like, no, that's it. American people are stupid. The country's stupid. And this is evidence of it. Look, that Trump is dominating and there's a million other reasons why we're stupid. And yeah, that's a fair analysis and that's a fair assessment. And you could argue that's what leads to the fact that we're almost turning the movie Idiocracy into a documentary. But I think it's a little more complicated than that. So on historical facts and with, like, knowledge, are the American people kind of stupid? Yeah. I mean, I've seen the polls and a scary percentage of them can't name the three branches of government and don't know basic facts, like who the fucking vice president is. And it's like, so yeah, on basic facts and knowledge, you can say they're ignorant is the right word. They're not idiots. They're just ignorant, okay? But when it comes to things that what their innate feelings are, what their gut reaction is when you ask them various political opinions, they're actually not stupid. They're not, and they're really not masochistic, is it the best way to put it. They kind of know what's right and what's wrong in terms of what to implement. So what I mean by that is, when you ask the American people, hey, do you want a Medicare for all system? They say yes. When you ask the American people, hey, you know, the inequality is a little crazy. You think we should tax the rich more? They say yes. When you ask the American people, hey, do you want to cut Social Security and Medicare? They say under no circumstances. When you ask the American people, hey, should we legalize weed? Yes. Hey, should we allow gay marriage? Yes. So you go down the list, the American people are fairly committed leftists. So their gut feelings on which direction to take the country, I think it's correct. Again, they're ignorant of historical facts and stuff like that. But in terms of what their gut reaction is to which direction we should take the country, I think they're 100% right. So then the logical question becomes, well, how can we have a political system that's so immensely fucked up? And there, the answer becomes money and politics and the establishment. So to say that, hey, the movie Idiocracy is becoming a documentary, it's hyperbole, it's a flippant comment, there's a kernel of truth in it. But overall, it's probably wrong because it's not like the American people are just stupid. It's the fact that our government has not been representing us at all for years. So people are just turning to any kind of solution they can imagine in order to try to fix that. And that actually explains the rise of Trump. When you have Congress that recently had a 9% approval rating in a fucking democracy, a 9% approval rating, how does that happen? You voted for the people. How does that happen? It's because they're not representing you. It's because they're representing their donors. So when that's the case, when the government and the establishment is so utterly non-interested in your well-being and what you want and what's supposed to be a representative democracy, well, then people are going to go, anything but these douchebags. So anything but the polished guys who pretend like they're for me, but they're not for me because they're never for me, anything but that. So then that's how you get somebody like Donald Trump who rises up and every once in a while on economic issues, he says, I'm going to bring factory jobs back here. I'm not going to let corporations move overseas. I'm going to do massive infrastructure spending. Says things that aren't even conservative. Says things that are fairly liberal in a Republican primary. And the Republican voters go, yeah, whatever, labels, liberal, conservative, who gives a fuck? That guy's for me. Now, whether or not he's going to do it is a different question. I don't think he's going to do it. You probably don't think he's going to do it. But that message is resonating. The message of, look at these puppets. They're all puppets. Jeb, you take any more money from special donors today? Marco, are you a puppet to Sheldon Adelson and the rest of them? People hear that, they go, yeah, fuck those guys. Fuck the donors. Fuck the establishment. Anything but the establishment. And then out of their justified desperation, they go, I'm going to go for that guy. So I think it's kind of unfair to the American people. I always say my weird little phrase that I made up about this is the American people are politically schizophrenic. They're ignorant of the history, and they're just ignorant of facts in general, but they're right in terms of on policy positions, what they think makes more sense. They're not in favor of hurting themselves more, like I just went through with you. They're in favor of liberal ideas kind of across the board. So they're schizophrenic. They're really shitty and ignorant, but they're also right on the actual policy issues and what they want. So to just say it's an idiocracy and they're dumb, no. There's actually a logical explanation as to why you have a guy like Trump who's doing well in a primary and why he might be the next president. And it's really not the fault of the American people almost at all. It's entirely the fault of corruption and money in politics and a government that Princeton researchers found is effectively an oligarchy in the U.S. now, no longer a democracy. Okay. Now, let's continue here. I'm going to give you guys some good news. We have some good news today on the issue of paid leave. Huffington Post reports here more than 800,000 U.S. workers may be getting paid sick leave on their jobs thanks to a federal rule outlined by the Labor Department on Wednesday. The proposal set in motion an executive order from President Barack Obama in September and would guarantee that workers under federal contracts could accrue up to a week of paid leave per year. Companies that want to maintain their business with the government would be required to offer the leave as a benefit. Okay, so this is a step in the right direction, and to be fair to Obama here, this is as much as he could possibly do without having to go through Congress. So this is him saying, hey, if it's a federal government job, you know, I as the president, I'm actually the head of the executive branch, so I control all the executive agencies, so I don't need to go through Congress to say, if we're going to do contracts with you, you have to offer paid leave. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. If you don't offer it, then that's it. Your contract is done, and we'll bring in somebody else who will offer people paid leave. So, again, this is a giant step in the right direction. If I'm not mistaken, I think the exact number is 875,000 people who might get paid sick leave by law if he does this. Now, the downside here is since we have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, there is almost no chance of getting paid sick leave for the country through. I mean, think about that, man. Isn't that amazing that, like, people voted in the Republicans out of their desperation? They felt like, oh, my God, the government's not representing me, so let's go to the worst people and see if they'll help us. And then when you get to a basic question like paid vacation by law, which every other modern nation has, they're like, elect you because they were desperate and they wanted somebody to represent them? Yeah, we don't care. So you poll the American people, they're like, yeah, I'd like paid vacation. But then you ask their representatives, they're like, fuck off. No way. Why? Because they're representing the corporations. They're not representing the people. I mean, the Republican Party is a fucking farce. It's a joke. If you get rid of the corporate money that's propping them up, they're gone tomorrow. And Trump is kind of exposing that right now. How, you know, you pour all the money into Jeb! Exclamation mark, and pour it all into Scott Walker at the beginning and Marco Rubio. And what happens? This is their campaign. And Trump's soaring by him because he's daring to say stuff like, I'll keep jobs in the U.S., I'll do infrastructure spending, some genuine populist rhetoric that the other guys don't do because they think, ooh, that's icky liberalism. But he's like, yeah, I don't care about labels. This is what I'm saying I'm going to do. I don't think he's actually going to do it. But people hear that and they go, yeah, yeah, that guy. There's an article yesterday about how union people are like, I think I'm going to vote for Trump. Again, it's because of the rhetoric. Will he actually do it? Fuck no. He has his ties made in China, so he's talking tough like, oh, I'm going to crack down on people sending jobs to China. Bitch, bring your own jobs back first before you talk about other people. You're not going to do it. He's not going to do it. But it's his rhetoric. His rhetoric, and people go, yeah, I'm with that. So you have a Republican Congress that's so immensely detached from the American people that a common-sense idea like this, not a chance to get through. So Obama's saying, I'm going to do as much as I can on this front, and hopefully – you know, this sets a precedent or it's some sort of a benchmark, something to strive for in the future when Congress isn't so absolutely moronic. And I need you to understand just how much you're getting fucked over here, because I want to take a look at a chart of the U.S. versus other modern nations and how much paid leave they get. And when you see that, you go, oh, that's right. Our government simply does not represent us, does not give a fuck about us. They represent the corporations. They represent the billionaires. They represent the special interests. So you can see here, See, all the way on the right, it says the United States, zero paid holidays, zero paid vacation days by law. All those other countries have a paid time off by law, virtually every other modern nation. Guys, we are an embarrassment on this front. We're a joke. We rely on the benevolence, non-benevolence of big businesses to give us time off as part of the contract. Oh, please, please, please. Corporations are not just going to do that. They need to be compelled to do that. And this is the whole idea of marketplace regulation. You don't let them set the rules. You make some basic rules for them. And look, even in other modern nations, this isn't that much time. Like, some places really do get as much as, like, a month off, which is impressive. But, like, to say, hey, you know, you need to at least be allowed 1 year off, one month off per year paid, that's not radical. I mean, you're still working, like, 11 out of 12 months. If anything, that's still radical in the other direction, that you're busting your ass 11 out of 12 months. And it's just our whole mindset on work is beyond fucked up. It's like you live to be in this gigantic corporate machine in America. You rent your labor on the marketplace, and then you die. How about no? How about we try something smarter? Now, I'm not some sort of crazy radical where I want to totally scrap capitalism. I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think you need a mix of socialism and capitalism in order for a system to work. But I don't get why the default position wouldn't be, given all the technology we have and all the ability to do wealth creation, why wouldn't the starting position in the debate be half the time you work, half the time you're off? Why wouldn't that be the starting position? No, the starting position was you work every day that you're alive, and then we had to chip away at that over time, where unions fought for 2 days off for the weekend, and, you know, over time you got a little bit more vacation time, but not by law. So it's bullshit. It's utter bullshit. The starting point should be 50-50. And, it's not like if people say, okay, that's unrealistic, man. No, you're being unrealistic. You're just an apologist for a broken system right now that fucks over people. We have enough technology. We have enough machinery to be able to have it so people work only half the year and take off the other half the year. All you'd have to do is assign people a machine that works for them and then give them the cash that, you know, is created through the productivity of the machine. That's all you have to do. But we've made it so that the billionaires and the rich and the corporations have rigged the system where they fuck you over and you think you're getting a good deal if you just get a week off per year. Please, what a sick, sick joke this is. So it's a step in the right direction from the Obama administration, but we got a long way to go, because especially with technology getting better and better, the economy is going to fundamentally change. And we can have the machines take over and basically – I sound like Bill O'Reilly. The machines are taking over. We can have technology take over and everybody loses their jobs and everybody's poor and then there's a revolution. Or we can do it the right way and, yes, distribute wealth, redistribute wealth in a smart way and make it so that moving into the future we can have shared prosperity. Okay. Now, let's see. Yeah, I'm going to take my final break here, and then when we come back, I'm going to give you a chilling fact about workers, which kind of speaks to what we were just talking about with the paid vacation time. Wait until you see what the future holds for low-wage workers. It ain't pretty, and we're at a crossroads in terms of how we move forward and how we treat low-wage workers in the country. This is a really important story. You don't want to miss it. And then as we move along here, Bernie Sanders was asked whether or not he believes in God yet again. And then we'll get to the I think, very important BDS story where there's been a massive crackdown on free speech and free expression. If you dare say we should boycott Israel so that we force them into a peace deal. So stay right there. We got all that and much more. We'll be right back.
Drop lyrics off and on like a light switch. Quick to grab the right bitch and make her drive the cute 40.
Has just come out and admitted a chilling fact about workers in America and their future prospects. So Huffington Post reports here. In a report to Congress this week, White House economists forecast an 83% chance that workers earning less than $20 an hour will lose their jobs to robots. Wage earners who receive up to $40 in hourly pay face a 31% chance they'll be replaced by robots, while workers who are paid more than $40 an hour face much lower odds, about 4% of losing their jobs to automation. So what I take away from this is now we even have the establishment acknowledging it. The transition over is inevitable. Like we're going to have an economy that's largely run by technology, like they say, robots, like Bill O'Reilly says, the machines, the rise of the machines, Skynet, some would say. And there's really nothing you can do to stop it. It's like the natural evolution of technology. And we've already gotten to a point where a lot of people have lost their jobs as a result of this. But now they're saying an 83% chance that workers earning less than $20 an hour are going to lose their jobs to robots. Now, they don't give a time frame and say how, you know, in what time span that's going to happen. But I don't know if there's a good answer to that anyway, even if they say, hey, it's 100 years off in the future. Kind of fucked for low-wage workers. So this brings up an interesting conversation, and something Stephen Hawking said about this recently really shines through now. And the question is, which direction do we go? Because we have two paths moving forwards. We're at a crossroads here. Either you go in the direction of continued oligarchy in the U.S. and plutocracy, kleptocracy in the U.S., or you go in the direction of we have to be more rational about how to fix the system and, yes, redistribute wealth. So if we go the direction of a rigged system where the rich control it and the corporations control it, well, then people lose their jobs. Even low-wage earners now make nothing. And machines or technology, robots take over. And then there's a growing rift, a continued growing rift between rich and poor, to the point where, you know, I don't know how the numbers could get much worse, but right now 62 people have more wealth than the bottom. 3.7 billion, 62 people more than 50%. Well, are we going to get to a point where, like, 100 people have all the money, all the wealth in the world, or 1,000 people have all the money, all the wealth, and everybody else has, like, 0.5%, and we share it among billions of people? That's a recipe for disaster. I mean, that's a recipe for legit revolution or, I mean, I hate to sound Alex Jonesy here, but that is a recipe for, would elites take some sort of measure, whether it's forced sterilization or controls on how many kids you can have or some sort of depopulation efforts? I mean, if it gets to that point, what other option is there? You got billions of pissed off people who have no way of fucking feeding themselves and keeping a roof over their head, and you got everything. That's a weird sci-fi, you know, path we go down there. It's a weird thriller kind of movie that actually becomes real life. So what do you do in that respect? And how do we predict exactly what's going to happen? Well, I mean, look, we can avoid it all if we just do the right thing in terms of distributing wealth properly, redistributing wealth properly, and we make it so that, as I kind of alluded to in the last segment, you assure that people will have enough well-being or enough financial stability to be okay. And the way you do that is you can assign people, hey, this robot is your robot. Whatever they produce in the marketplace, you get. So you're assigned one robot or two or three or ten or whatever the fuck it is. They do your work for you. You get the money. And we all kind of live in a weird semi-utopian society where everybody makes a stable income, like a middle-class living. You all have health care, a roof over your head, nice houses, nothing but leisure time all the time. And it's like run by the robots who are kind of servants of us and what our will is. Or if we don't go in that direction, it's game, set, match. I mean, it can only be disaster if you continue with the levels of wealth inequality and you don't set up a system where people are okay when you have machinery, technology, robots take over. But, I mean, obviously the scary aspect to this is which path is most likely right now. We all know what it is. And it ain't the one where you get a robot assigned to you and then you make a decent amount of money because of the productivity of your robot. It's much more likely, at least at this moment, that the elites continue to stay greedy and go down the wrong path. And what's amazing is they don't get that it benefits them to do it the other way. Because nobody's saying, hey, abolish rich people. Nobody's saying that. What we're saying is let's be reasonable about how we do the wealth distribution. Doesn't mean you can't be rich. So it's like I was always amazed by, like, the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession. These corporations and these billionaires, they would package together shitty toxic assets and then sell them to the next guy. And they thought, yay, we're getting rich in the short run, so it's okay. But you idiots, in the long term, you're crashing the economy, which is going to come to bite you in the ass. You know, when historically in the U.S., when you had the rich people making 25, 26% of all the income, the top 1% making 26%, that leads to recessions and depressions because then people can't afford to go buy the goods of the so-called captains of industry that they make. So when you have that, it sucks for everybody in the long run. And when you have a better wealth distribution between 9% and 12% of the income going to the top 1%, then we have a stable system. So they don't get that doing better or redistribution of wealth that makes sense actually benefits them in the long run too. But they're so greedy in the short run and in the short term that they can't see straight and they don't know how the system works, so they don't know it's all going to come crashing down on them if all they care about is profit in the short term. And this is exactly what we're looking at here. Either we go in the right direction with distribution or we go in the wrong direction, and it's a disaster for all of humanity. Oops. God damn it. I dropped my pen. Here it is. Okay. We'll see. All I know is people much, much smarter than me have given that analysis. I didn't come up with that analysis. That's an analysis that Stephen Hawking came up with, and I'm just pawning off and explaining here as to what the choices are moving forwards where we have, like, literally robots taking over. So Skynet possibly is becoming real life. All right, now we go to Bernie Sanders and his belief in God and the hacky questions that just never stop against this guy. Bernie Sanders was questioned about his belief in God yet again. Let's watch.
Is there a higher power? Is there a higher intelligence? What do you believe in?
This is what I believe. Every great religion in the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, essentially comes down to do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. I believe it in my whole life, that we are in this together, not just not words. The truth is, at some level, when you hurt, when your children hurt, I hurt. I hurt. And when my kids hurt, you hurt. But I believe that what human nature is about is that everybody in this room impacts everybody else in all kinds of ways that we can't even understand. It's beyond intellect. It's a spiritual, emotional thing. So I believe that when we do the right thing, when we try to treat people with respect and dignity, when we say that that child who is hungry is my child, I think we are more human when we do that than when we say, hey, this whole world is me. I need more and more. I don't care about anybody else. That's my religion. That's what I believe in.
So that was a fantastic answer, but make no mistake about it, they're trying to play gotcha with him. This is, what, the third time that he's been asked this question in various debates and town halls? And the fuller context here, Cuomo, you know, went on, he prods, and he's like, right, but on God, do you believe in a God? I was joking at the time on Twitter. It's like, do you believe in a man in the sky or not, Bernie? That's what this is about. And it is trying to play gotcha. It is trying to corner him. It is trying to, you know, ask a question where you could turn around later and say, me? I wasn't trying to get him in any way, shape, or form. I'm just asking a question. But the intent of it is to trip him up and is to get him to say something that damages his chances moving forward. And this is a giant catch-22, guys, because let's assume, for argument's sake here for a second, he's an atheist, which he might be with an answer like that. But if he says, yeah, I don't believe. I don't believe in God. Okay, he could probably just lose the race on that. That's the potential massive downside. But then on the other side of that is, it does end up pushing against anti-atheist bigotry, which is such a gigantic problem in the world that I didn't even realize how gigantic a problem it was. We covered a story the other day on it where I gave you all the details, all the numbers. You know, people are more likely to rule out an atheist than any other kind of person, just up front. They could agree with you on every political issue, but if you say you're an atheist, you know, people say, in the U.S., 53% of the population says, if you're an atheist, you are immoral, period. Atheism equals immorality. In other words, when they tell you, if somebody tells you, I'm an atheist, 53% of the U.S. hears, I am immoral, I don't believe in right and wrong. So there's tremendous anti-atheist bigotry in the country. And it's possible that somebody like Bernie Sanders, given how far he's already come and how much, a large portion of the population likes him, that if he says that, people go, oh, okay, so they're not that crazy. But on the other hand, you do lose plenty of votes, and it makes it so that it might tank his chances. And remember, this is before the South Carolina primary. South Carolina, very, very religious. Even on the Democratic side, very religious. So this is an attempt to trip him up. Look, I'm at the point, man, where I find it amazing that if you're somebody who believes in space fairies and you argue for that and you give stump speeches about that and you talk about your space fairies, like that's a plus in many people's eyes. But if you say the opposite, no, I don't believe in space fairies, but I still want to treat people good, but I don't believe in space fairies, that hurts your campaign. So I'm at the point where it's like we shouldn't in adult society, why should questions about this be asked in any way? Like, why would you ask anybody about, like, I don't give a shit. As long as you're making decisions in a rational way on this earth, and, hey, I want to make things better on this earth, and I don't have any, concerns about the afterlife, whatever, then that should be the focus of the campaign. It shouldn't be, here's my goofy personal beliefs and the space fairies I believe in, and, I'm going to use this as something to try to get me elected, because I believe in fairy tales and whatnot. No, that's backwards. It's backwards. I don't know why it's a concern for anybody in the first place. If you're running and you have to bring that up, and you do bring that up, that should be something that the voters look more down on you for doing, because they go, okay, but what does that have to do with how you're going to run the country? If you're bringing up the mythology and how you're going to run the country, shouldn't that be something that worries me more than it's like, oh, yay, believes in my space fairy? So our mindset is totally backwards when it comes to this stuff, and it really annoys me that this is even an issue. In other modern nations, they're not, hey, what mythology do you believe in? They don't do that. They don't do that because it's not that's got nothing to do with how you run the country. In fact, it kind of, pokes at the fundamental premise the U.S. was founded on, one of them at least, of separation of church and state, and you shall not establish a religion. When you start asking people, like, but what religion do you believe in? Well, then aren't you saying these things are going to affect how I govern? Isn't there a connection there when there shouldn't be? So it's just so juvenile in how we approach this. And I do think they're trying to trip up Bernie. And I do think it's a weird, strange line of questioning. And I do think that we should move away from this and start acting like more reasonable nations. Okay. Now, let me go to Ben Carson. Who did the most ironic attack of all time? Ben Carson thought it would be a brilliant idea to question Obama's blackness.
Some struggles that you came through, you recently talked about President Obama and maybe not having the authentic black experience. Maybe you could be the first real black president. What did you mean by that?
Well, I simply was responding to something that someone was saying, and the fact of the matter is, he did not grow up in black America. He grew up in white America. Doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that when the claim is made that he represents the black experience, it's just not true.
You're going to question Obama's blackness? You're going to question Obama's blackness. Ben Carson is going to question Obama's blackness. I'm holding back. This isn't my place to interject here and say what I truly, deeply believe. That's a lot like Herman Cain questioning Obama's blackness, if you know what I'm saying. It's a lot like Alan West or Alan Keyes questioning Obama's blackness. What do all these people have in common? Sure, they're all black. They're also super conservative. And they really, really, really are on the side of other white bigots. Funny how they find it necessary to question Obama's blackness. please, man, God, how I wish Obama comes out and just keeps it real on this. I mean, he's not going to do it because very rarely does he comment on the current race. But he should do a press conference where he just says what I've been saying, which is Ben Carson is going to question my blackness. Ben Carson is going to question my blackness. Ben Carson. Ben Carson. Come on, dude. Come on. No, this is unbelievable. Now, understand the most important aspect to this, though. What is it that conservatives say all the time about liberals? Oh, look at these liberals always playing the race card. I can't believe race card, always a race card. Why are you always going to the race card? Why do you have to go to the race card? That's so stupid. Why would you do that? Why would you go to the race card? Well, that is nothing but sheer projection. That is utter projection. Because what's going on with Ben Carson here? He's had an abysmal showing in the primaries and caucuses so far. He's done. His campaign is over, even though he's staying in. Probably to sell more books, by the way. But so he's doing horrible. And he goes down the polls, down the polls, down the polls. When he thinks, okay, I gotta go nuclear here, what does he do? You know I'm black, right? I'm black. I could be the first real black president. That's a reason to vote for me. You gonna vote for me? I'm black. Did I mention I'm black? Oh, my goodness. How sad are you? You're doing the thing that you guys accuse liberals of doing of all the time. By the way, how many times did Obama try to use the color of his skin as a positive when he ran? Please, he almost never brought it up. Bill Maher says something about Obama that's really true. He says he's the Jackie Robinson of American politics. The first black president elected in a country that in fucking the 1960s still had segregation. The country founded on slavery. The first black president was elected. He had to be perfect. If there was a whiff from the white majority of, oh, he's trying to use this as like a, you know, you owe us kind of thing, or if he comes across as a stereotypical angry black man, they would have ran away from him and not voted for him. So he had to be perfect. He never brought it up. And he's given so many speeches that, you know, a lot of progressives, including myself, would largely disagree with, where he just kind of lectures black families and he's like, the fathers need to stay around more and this and that. So in no way did he do it. Ben, you're doing it right now. Liberals always play the race card. But hey, by the way, I know I'm doing shitty in the polls now. Have I mentioned I'm black? You might want to vote for me because I'm black. Black conservative. I could be the real first black president. Obama, does he count? No, he doesn't count. Come on now. I'm questioning his blackness. Again, I come back to my main point. Ben Carson questioning another black man's blackness. The comedy writes itself. All right, now, let's go to the BDS story here, which I think is a very, very important story. There's been a growing backlash in the West to the BDS movement, which is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which is attempting to force Israel into a peace deal. And I want to give you a few examples of this from recent stories here. First off, we have this, a billboard in Chicago that says Boycott Israel, it's a pro-BDS billboard, was pulled after protesters said it's anti-Jewish. They have a quote from somebody who complained to the company that put it up, and they said, well, what they're really saying is, it says boycott Israel, what they're really saying is boycott Jews. This is anti-Semitism. So what happened? The company completely buckled under the pressure. They pulled the billboard. Okay, then we have the government in the UK also announcing last week that it's now illegal for, quote, local councils, public bodies, and even some university student unions to refuse to buy goods and services from companies involved in the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. Is that, hey, if you do that, no government funding whatsoever. We will cut it solely based on the fact that you came out in favor of a movement to boycott Israel to try to stop their illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. So, in other words, you legally have to be for illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. If you speak out against it, you're done. All your funding is cut. You're gone. And then we have this. Now, some people might hear what we have so far here, and they say, okay, you got the UK government. They don't have free speech like the U.S. does or free expression in the same way that the U.S. does. So it's shitty, but hey, that's their legal system. This is, you know, a counter-argument I can imagine somebody making. And to the Chicago one, they could say, all right, but the company that put it up responded to the pressure, so it's not the government restricting speech. It's just the company deciding, hey, they don't want to be a part of it because some people are offended. Okay, fine. But what else is happening in the U.S.? Well, let's dive into it. Quote, nearly half the states in the country are considering legislation aimed at countering BDS. Some bills seek to legitimize Israeli settlements or go so far in punishing boycott supporters they infringe on constitutionally protected speech. Two states, Illinois and South Carolina, passed laws last year mandating state divestment from companies that boycott Israel. Another 11 states are considering similar laws. Kansas and Pennsylvania are debating legislation that would defund universities that participate in an Israel boycott. And another six states are considering or have adopted non-binding resolutions condemning Israel boycotts. Damn. So they say half the states in the U.S. are like, okay, how can we shut down free speech and free expression when people say, I want to boycott Israel to stop the illegal settlements. I'm against occupation. You're not allowed to have that. The kingdom has deemed that opinion is not nice, and we don't agree with it. Therefore, you're done. We're going to cut off your funding. We're going to find backdoor ways to limit free speech and free expression. So make no mistake about it. This is an attack on free speech and free expression. And furthermore, this is a way to try to counteract U.S. policy over the last 50 years on the illegal settlement front, because the U.S. has said for 50 years, yeah, those are illegal and we don't recognize them. But this is a way to try to change that policy in a backdoor way where they go through all the states and they basically criminalize anybody who supports a boycott to try to prevent the illegal settlements. Oh, this is not good. This is not good. Now, I assume all the free speech warriors out there, I consider myself part of that, if not one of the leaders of that, I assume all of them will come out and say, look, even if I don't agree with boycotting Israel, and even if I'm not pro-BDS, free speech is free speech, free expression is free expression, this is clearly a way to try to silence people who have that opinion, I'm not in favor of that. I'll wait for the parade of people to follow on this one and say, yeah, that is kind of fucked up. Guys, if this was for any other state, you wouldn't have this in the U.S. You wouldn't have it. You wouldn't. If people were saying, hey, man, we want to boycott, an Islamic country, say, Saudi Arabia. Bad example, because in the U.S., we might actually protect Saudi Arabia. We protect them in every way, shape, and form. But if you want to do it on Iran, oh, my God. Oh, yeah, rock on. Free speech, free expression. Fuck Iran. This is not something that would be allowed on any other front with any other issue. Did you know that in France now, they've pretty much banned being in favor of BDS and voicing that opinion? If you do it, it's considered anti-Semitic hate speech. And that gets to the heart of this issue here. Not only is it a crackdown on free speech and free expression, it also conflates something that it makes no sense to conflate. It says, hey, if you criticize the right-wing policies and the state of Israel, that is equal to anti-Semitism, which is hatred irrational hatred of Jews, ethnic Jews. That is not the same thing. I vehemently oppose anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews. Of course I do. In the same way I oppose anti-Muslim bigotry, in the same way I oppose anti-atheist bigotry, in the same way I oppose racism and homophobia and everything like that. But I'm allowed to criticize the state of Israel, and it's not anti-Semitic. I'm allowed to criticize the policies of the state of Israel, and it's not anti-Semitic. To say otherwise is as stupid as saying, you're against the Iraq war, you're anti-American, man. Why ain't you a patriot? That's just a stupid argument. It just doesn't make any sense. It's as stupid as when I come out here and I say, hey, I disagree with the doctrine of Islam. It's wrong. There are parts in the Quran or the Hadith where it talks about stoning gays or throwing them off a building, or that's totally wrong. Is that anti-Muslim bigotry that I said that? Fuck no. I'm against the ideas and the concepts in the holy books. I'm against that. That's not the same as saying I'm an anti-Muslim bigot who hates all Muslims. by the same token, to criticize the right-wing government of Israel is not saying, hey, I hate all Jews. But in Europe now, it's getting to that point where laws are being passed where they say, no, you're not even allowed to say you're in favor of a boycott, divestment, and sanction movement because that's against all Jews. No, that is stupid, and that is a complete attempt at censorship and shutting down free speech and free expression. And they're doing it, by the way, because it's working. Because BDS is the only effective, efficient way that in the long run will force Israel into a two-state solution which recognizes a free and independent Palestine and gives them the right to self-determination. That's the heart of the issue here. In apartheid South Africa, it worked. In Israel, it'll work. That's why they're freaking out. That's why the West is passing all these anti-BDS laws, because at a certain point, they have no choice. What are you going to do? But we've boycotted you. We've done divestments. We've done sanctions. You're economically isolated. You become much more poor. And then Netanyahu or whoever's in power at the time will have to say, okay, no mas, we're done here. You twisted my arm. I'm in a corner. Yes, we'll do a two-state deal with the Palestinians along the 67 borders, share Jerusalem, build a giant wall, which I'm in favor of. You know, that's – if they're not going to do it, you know, out of their own volition here, well, then you fucking force them to do it. And you say, it's not just a different opinion if you're in favor of occupation and oppression of the Palestinians. That's not a thing. That's not a respectable position. That's like being on the side of apartheid South Africa. It's like, no, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to have apartheid. We're going to treat them like second-class citizens, and that's the end of the conversation. Or how about no? How about we don't accept that? How about we move in the right direction here? And if you're not going to do it willingly, we'll force you to do it. And by the way, you could stop all this tomorrow. Just do the deal right now. You want BDS to end tomorrow? Do the two-state deal along the 67 border, share Jerusalem, call it a day. But you're not going to do that. So guess what? We're going to make you do that. How you like me now? Okay. Let me give you one more here. I certainly won't have time for more than that, unfortunately. The Guardian is reporting that Iran's 27-year-long fatwa against author Salman Rushdie is now $600,000 richer. They say, quote, 40 state-run media outlets pooled together to increase the bounty offered for Rushdie's killing. The fatwa was issued by late Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini in 1989 after the publication of Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, which Khomeini regarded as being blasphemous against Islam. So for those of you who don't know, Rushdie needed to go into hiding and hire permanent bodyguards as a result of this. They say, while Rushdie has survived the fatwa unscathed, several other people involved in the publication of the book have been less lucky. Hitoshi Igarashi, the Japanese translator, was stabbed to death in 1991, and the Italian translator Ettore Capriolo barely survived a stabbing attack at his Milan apartment in 1991. In addition, the Turkish translator Aziz Nesin escaped an arson attack on a hotel in 1993 in which 37 people were killed, and the Norwegian publisher William Nygaard, I know I'm pronouncing that wrong, my apologies, survived being shot three times in Oslo in 1993. Iran withdrew from the Frankfurt Book Fair last year after Rushdie was announced as a speaker. This is incredible, man. Look at that last fact. Iran's like, oh, we're leaving. We're so offended that you're bringing in Salman Rushdie to do a speech. You know what I'm offended by? Your fucking fatwa, which got people killed and is still going on against Salman Rushdie right now. Like, oh, we're so offended he's going to speak. Now we're going to kill him. I'm offended by you trying to kill him. How about that? How about that? Like, he is the victim, and they're like, oh, my God, we're the victims. We must leave. Salman Rushdie's coming. How victimized are we? We're so oppressed. You're not oppressed, you little punk bitches. And that gets to the heart of this issue here. In the mind of these Islamic fundamentalists, the Shia Islamists in Iran, they believe, like, no, you wrote a book that I disagree with, therefore I have a right to kill you because you victimize me, you oppress me, and this is unacceptable. They're so disconnected from reality that they don't get that the real victimization and oppression is you doing it to Salman Rushdie. See, the way civilized people act is they go, oh, you have an opinion, I have a differing opinion, we can argue, we can debate, but at the end of the day, it is what it is, and we all move along. And that's it. But these guys think, no, if you disagree with me, I have a right to kill you. Now, what's at the heart of that, man, to psychologically analyze them here? They do that because they know they can't really win in the realm of ideas. You're not right. You're dead wrong. Your beliefs are fundamentally stupid. So since you can't actually convince somebody with debate and conversation, you have to start when you brainwash them from their youth to force them to believe what you believe. Since you can't convince them, you revert to violence and say, I will force you to believe this or I will kill you if you disagree. That ain't strength, bitch. That's fundamental weakness, and you show it here to the point where they just renewed the fatwa against him for $600,000 more when this is something that dates back to the 1980s. How pathetic are you? How grotesque are you? And by the way, the younger generation in Iran is also disgusted by this. Iran is a very young country on average, and the younger ones are much more secular and liberal than these fucking dinosaurs in control. So they're shooting themselves in the foot here when they act this stupid. Tick tock, your time's running out. Okay, I'm out of time, guys. I love you. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place, for a great Friday show. Peace.